Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale.
The Habit of Rivers is a masterwork. I think it's a wonderful book. They all do something different. McGuane has a better overview of everything. I believe that Ted is an excellent writer within the philosophic and also the larger view. But if you look at the difference between a Leeson story or article and a McGuane is capable of jumping in a variety of different directions, exploding in different directions.
That was Nick Lyons talking about two of the greatest contemporary fly fishing writers of our time. We have the man who published and produced some of our greatest fishing books in modern day history, Nick Lyons, today on the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the Fly Fishing Show. Wanted to give a quick shout out to our members supported group at the members society. If you want to help keep the lights on here, just head over to wetflyswing.com/members. And you can join there for about the cup of a nice juicy cup of coffee, a good cup of coffee. So check it out if you get a chance. Nick Lyons, one of the most influential people in publishing in the publishing world, shares the story of how he put it all together today and some of the great writers he's worked with over the years. We hear about Dave Whitlock, Gary LaFontaine, John Gearock, Art Flick, Hemingway, and even Earl the Pearl Monroe. This one, you know, if there's an Earl the Pearl Monroe sighting, that's going to be a good one. Before we get started, let's hear from our sponsors. Sawyer offers a full line of modern and traditional products for oarsmen, canoeists, kayakers, and paddlers from all genres, providing unsurpassed function, performance, and beauty. The Sawyer Artisan Oar is their very popular square top oar with carbon fiber X-weave fiberglass shaft reinforcement, featuring prints of fish species from artists around the country, passionate about fisheries and fishing art. These oars showcase Sawyer's and the artist's ability to create rugged yet highly functional art. Head over to wetflyswing.com/Sawyer to grab your set today. I'm also happy to share another great sponsor we have with us this year. OPST's rods represent decades of dedication to sustained anchor two-handed casting. A rod reflects its designer, and these rods are a true illustration of Skagit Master Ed Ward's vision. The Micro Series, from 3 to 5 weight, comes exceptionally close to single-handed specs and is proving to be a unique tool for trout and smallmouth anglers. Head over to wetflyswing.com/OPST to check out the lineup right now. That's wetflyswing.com/OPST. Another mega episode for you today. So without further ado, here is Nick Lyons of Lyons Press Publishing. Let's do it. How's it going, Nick?
I'm here and I'm delighted to be here with you, Dave.
Thanks for taking this call, in our podcast this morning. I'm really excited to hear back from you. I think I might have heard you on, we talked a while back. I think maybe, I don't know if it was a year ago or longer, but I was kind of trying to get you on. And then I think you had some things, some health complications, which I'm really excited that you kind of came out of it. But I heard you recently on the Orvis podcast. I was like, oh man, Nick's still out there. I gotta reconnect with him. So that's why I'm
still out there and still able to talk a little.
All right. Good stuff. Well, you're a huge influence on fly fishing and really outdoors and everything you've done in the publishing world. But maybe you can just tell us how you first got into fly fishing.
I should start by saying that I started to fish when I was about five. I was at a little boarding school, and the presence of a pond called the Ice Pond, where revolutionary folks used to get their ice, filled with sunfish and bullheads and perch, other kinds of odds and ends. And I fished the way a lot of us started, with either a bent hook first and then a hook, and a stick first and then a rod. And I fished all through my teen years with great passion, and through my college years. It was after college that I watched somebody from a bridge in Michigan. I was at the University of Michigan. I watched somebody, I was standing on the bridge looking down, and had a view of a first-rate fly fisherman casting toward the bank, toward under the overhanging branches on one of those sweepers on the Orsable. And so watched the fly and watched the trout come up and take it. And the great beauty of the casting, and then the excitement of watching that fish come up and take a dry fly, sent me out of my mind. I got rid of all of my spinning equipment and started. This would have been when I was 26, I guess, which is really the beginning of my fly fishing. I was still at a stage when I would string up a rod by putting it through the hook keeper.
Yeah,
wooden cast.
Nice.
It was from that trip, really, that I started, and I mostly fished taught myself. My casting is still bad because of it, but I get the line out and I catch some fish.
That's awesome. Yeah, that sounds a lot like me with spay casting. I got into the spay casting game late, and because I taught myself from videos, I'm not as good as I probably would have been if I would have gotten instruction along the way. But no, I love it as well, and I think it's awesome you're here. You eventually got into, obviously writing, publishing, and Lions Press and everything. How did it become from that, starting out at age 26, into where you actually have a career in the fly fishing world, or, in publishing?
It was interesting. At Crown, where I was executive editor, I was also teaching full-time with a rather large family in New York. I got a second job, had myself transferred into the night session, and started to work in publishing as well as an editor, and eventually became the executive editor of a rather large publishing house, still very active. I think they did Obama's book, or as well, Michelle Obama's book.
Yeah.
I was looking for a specialty. I had no sense of where to look for a book or how to sign them up. And I had picked up a few that came in from agents. And then, since I was becoming passionate about fly fishing by this time, I asked some questions, looked around. Art Flick's Streamside Guide was the first book that I found.
Yep.
And I traced him to Westkill, New York, got the rights to his book, and then spread out. That book did so well so quickly. I remember Orvis did a first order of 5,000 copies, which was so unusual and so potent an advertisement for what this house thought they might sell, that they decided to let me go ahead. They had bought Derrydale Press in the 1940s, I believe, and had done very poorly with fly fishing and all fishing books, and at first were very reluctant. But when Orvis put in that huge order, they said, go ahead, get us more books like that.
Amazing.
I found The Marinaro, which I liked. I found wonderful Liza Ring book, The Art of Fishing the Wet Fly. I republished The Jennings, which they had the right to, Book of Trout Flies, and then did an anthology of my own called Fisherman's Bounty, which put me in touch with the entire so-called fishing community. And I began to read widely, and found a whole batch of other books. Art Flick had fished with Doug Swisher and Carl Richards and had recommended me when they asked about a fishing book publisher. And I remember they sent in Selective Trout, and I was at a reasonably primitive state of understanding what the trout saw and what the architectonics of a good trout fly could be. But when they presented that book to me, I had the slightest idea at first of whether they were mad or not, whether this stuff could work or whether it was just bizarre. Mm-hmm. Looked at it very, very closely. I remember for a week before I made any response, I finally thought that their logic was good, that what they said the trout was seeing pretty much had to be so. It was not, the hackle on the side was not there really to improve the verisimilitude of the fly, but really to make it ride a little better on the current, on the water. And the use of the no hackle was probably keying in on the body, which they thought was the key area. So I went with it. I worked very hard on it. I don't think they were great writers, but it was a cleanly argued and presented book, and the little work I did was not a great contribution. It went off like a rocket. One of the New York reviewers, Christopher Lehmanhaupt, was a fisherman. Eventually, I fished with him a few times. But he, I remember, wrote a review in a syndicated column that began, "If you're a trout fisherman, this book will change your life." And the book just started selling week after week in very large numbers. I think Crown reprinted it three or four times within the first year. And then other books would come to me that were very good. Lou Tabe, I would make tough decisions on which of the five or six saltwater fly fishing books were viable. Lefty's was, Lefty Craze, which I did, and Lou Tabery's, which was more specialized, mostly fishing for striped bass on the eastern coast. Was also a first-rate book, I thought. And I think from there on, it was my judgment. We got to be something on the order of, I had something on the order of 60 or 70 fly fishing books at that time. I think they were good ones. I think it was a valuable thing to bring back the old books, which provided the base for the entire company. And I can go further.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm interested. I love that you started off with Swisher and Richards, because that book still, to this day, comes up a lot, maybe more than any other book, as far as the impact on people and fly fishing. You know, some of the biggest names today still talk about that book. And so, but clarify now. So you mentioned Crown. So you were with Crown, and so was Crown the publisher of the Swisher and Richards, and then did you, and when did the Lionsgate or Lions Press come to be?
There was a very good publisher in England by the name of Timothy Benn, who ran Benn Brothers, or Ernest Benn Limited, which was a very 100-year-old British company. He was a serious fly fisherman. And just about this time, two or three things came together. The editor in chief was going to leave Crown, and I was asked if I wanted to stay on. They offered me relatively less, seriously less than it would have needed, than I would have needed to survive. I was also teaching full time then, and I think in my 50s by this time. And I couldn't really handle the two jobs together anymore. And just about then, Hunter College, where I taught, was beginning to get angry at me for having two jobs, more than the dean earned. So when Timothy Benn came to me, he asked me, would I start an American subsidiary for him and use my name as the head of it? This was a way for me to say I was consulting for the Benns and to last a little longer as a teacher, which I did. I turned down the possibility of becoming editor-in-chief and moved out of Crown and began what was called Nick Lyons Books, which was a wholly owned subsidiary of the Benn Group, and told them at Hunter that I was consulting for the British firm. It was an odd arrangement I had with them, with the Benns. They wanted me to do something called package books, which meant that I would sign them up, pay all the fees necessary, produce the book, and then sell an edition of the finished book to another company, which would then do the distribution. But it's a kind of fail-safe way to publish, and it's a way that I found very, very difficult and offensive to all of my values, that I would not see the book or be able to help with it, help promote it or sell it after it left my hands. It would be the job of Doubleday in the main case. We sold most of the fishing books to Doubleday and also to a rather unsuccessful at that time publishing house called Winchester Press. Winchester Press did some of them. I did this for them for several years, 3 years, published something on the order of 25 books, rather good ones, had no access to the Crown books at that time. And then my close friend Timothy Benn was discharged from his family business for some reason. And I was told that they were going to put me up for sale. Hmm. I said, well, there's nothing to sell. I'm the only asset. We've sold the rights to all of the books, to Doubleday and Schocken and Winchester. They have the rights to the books, the right to reprint. And so what you've got is a table and my Underwood Standard typewriter and me. I bargained rather hard with them. At the same time, raised a few hundred thousand dollars from six fishermen I knew, all of whom were rather wealthy, and signed documents saying that they were prepared to lose all of their money if this didn't work, and bought it away. And simultaneously, I decided to go to Crown and see if I couldn't get the rights to all of the books that I had edited there. I made a very good offer for me to get the rights, and took over all of those books also. So I had a base of about 60 or 70 mostly fly fishing books. When I started, I had the ones that I had came from Nick Lyons Books, the ones that came from Crown. By then it was a pretty good sized place, and I had to figure out ways to distribute the books and the ways to increase the size of the list. That was the beginning really of what became the Lyons Press, which I had control of. I had a partner for a while named Peter Burford in the business, a younger man, and I made him a partner rather a bit too early, perhaps.
Oh, yeah.
The business was called Lyons and Burford for some years. But eventually it was the Lyons Press. Got to be quite a decent size, and we had about 100 books on fly fishing. It was And then I stretched out from there and did books by Tom McGuane on horses and a variety of others on mountain climbing and other subjects. Some very, very good writers, and the business grew.
Wow. Well, yeah, that's, I wanted to hear you mentioned about, you know, choosing, the books, you know, you choose to publish. I want to get into that, but before we do, you mentioned Hunter Call, when you're at, Hunter Call, I guess, yeah. Is it Hunter? Yeah. That they got angry at you when you were, you know, kind of double or had two things going. What was that like? What did you mean by angry? And then how did you eventually, what was the break when you eventually cut that? How did that, all that happen?
That's a good question. Well, the dean called me down. He said, you know, I had gotten permission at the very beginning to have a second job. And he called me down and said, you can't do this. It's going to ruin your reputation as a teacher. I'm sure you can't teach as well if you're doing that much work. And I argued that, in fact, being a publisher, and I was already writing a lot at that time, writing a lot of fishing columns for the New Fly Fisherman and elsewhere. And I said, you know, the publishing had made me a better teacher. I'd learned how to edit well, and I passed this on to the students. Mm-hmm. It was a professional editing that they weren't going to get from most teachers. And I thought that I could tell them about the whole publishing process, as well as my great love, which was the teaching of literature itself. I can remember telling the chair of the English department that I thought I was a better teacher because of the time I'd spent. And she eventually got a grant for a considerable amount of money for me to teach a publishing course, which to me, I did with a quiet irony of success that I had. I really had not only bringing some special skills, but I was actually bringing some more business, so to speak, to the English department. Mm-hmm. Eventually, I had been an associate professor, and I went up for full professor. Which they asked me about my writing, and I gave them some of the technical writing I'd been doing at Literary Criticism, and also a list of all of the works that I'd done for Fly Fisherman, Field and Stream, and the other outdoor magazines. And I remember them asking me, someone asked me for at the meeting. For the promotion, asked me how water was related to what I was teaching. So I told them about writing, quoted a long passage from A.J. McLean in that distinguished literary quarterly Field and Stream. And it seemed that I floated through. I gave them a lot of names. Hague Brown. Mm-hmm. I hadn't heard of most of them. And I think that made it sound as if I had some special esoteric knowledge of some sort. You can't say bad things about him and about Hermann Hesse and the others if it's mixed in with Al McLean and a batch of such writers.
Yeah.
Then I was promoted to full professor.
Oh, wow. so you didn't leave that career. You stayed with that a little bit longer, but eventually did you leave it, or did you retire from that, the teaching?
I retired after 26 years.
Oh, wow.
I taught for a good while at Hunter. I think I did two jobs simultaneously for 17 or 18 years in that period. And, it was a great relief to retire. I'd love teaching. I'm very, very enthusiastic teacher of literature, which I had loved and which changed my life so much. This book that I've just written, A Fire in the Straw, is an account of a certain arc of my life. It begins with some fishing at this little boarding school, and it ends with a little pond I built in Woodstock, New York, and a trip to Montana. But the interesting point for me is that, and the reason it's titled that, Fire in the Straw, is that at, when I was in the Army, after I had graduated from the Wharton School with a degree in insurance, of all things, I did not know what I wanted to do. I did not want to go into insurance. Mm-hmm. I had not done well at school at all. I played basketball for Penn. That sort of held me together. But I had a period of about 2 or 3 years where I tried desperately to learn what this literature was that I had fallen in love with reading in the Army. Interestingly enough, but not surprising, it was the story Big Two-Hearted River, which I think set me in another direction entirely. The Hemingway story about a boy back from the Army who goes fishing by himself on a river he calls the Big Two-Hearted River, but which was the Fox River, I found out. But that there was something so real about it, and the fact that a story about fishing, which I thought I knew so well, could be so evocative and moving, and could be something called literature, as it is, that somehow I shifted in my whole focus and what I wanted to do and what I did. I went back to school as a freshman and then went on, quit as a freshman after the freshman year, and had myself shoehorned into the PhD program at the University of Michigan, which led to my fishing the Au Sable and which led to fly fishing. But it was a big change in my life. And I taught with great enthusiasm. But I had 4 children in New York, and I needed money. So I went into publishing also. And that became a very strong part of my life. I loved publishing. And I loved publishing books on fishing. Probably 120 or 130 on fly fishing alone.
Wow.
Good friends, wonderful older writers that I like Harry Plunkett Green and Skewies and others.
That's I'll put a link before we to your new book in the show notes so anybody can check that out that's listening here. I also wanted to highlight, I love that you mentioned basketball. That was my sport as well. So maybe at the end, if we have time, we'll dig into your position there. Well, I guess before we go, were you a guard or what was your position?
I was a guard. I had not played in high school. Interesting.
Oh wow!
I was probably about 5'6" when I got to the beginning of my senior year, and I couldn't make the team at Midwood High School. Had the worst team in New York. I couldn't make it, but I got onto the freshman team at Penn. I'd grown about 3 inches over the summer, and we had an All-American on the team, a man named Ernie Beck, who eventually went on to play for the Philadelphia Warriors. And we won the Ivy League, and we had quite a substantial team there for four years. I was on for 4 years.
4 years. So that seems amazing to me, the fact that you don't make the high school team and you actually play at a Division I college. I mean, what did you just work your butt off for a year in basketball? How'd you do it?
I've always been like that, Dave. With everything I do, I put everything that I have into it, and it was not enough to become a great ball player, but in the Army, I became a very, very good ball player. We played in France and won the divisional championship, and I played in SHAPE headquarters, and I think just lost to the people who won it. But I was very good in the Army and could touch the rim at 5'9". I could jump very high.
Huh.
Loved the game and loved fishing.
Yeah.
The two. And then finally, I couldn't do basketball and with four children, it was hard enough living in the city to get out and fish enough. So I guess I did these other things.
You did the other thing. Did you ever write anything about basketball? Any books or anything out there?
I did. There's a book called Take It to the Hoop, which is a very nice anthology on basketball. And I have a piece in that. And I've repeated that chapter in my new book, Fire in the Straw, about the day I gave up basketball and something of a quick overlook at my little career at it. I loved the game. It just seemed full of kind of verve and excitement and even dance. I love the way Steve Curry played that way, and that's really the kind of game I had.
Oh yeah, so you're like a sharp shooter, or
I was not, but I'm thinking of his inside.
Oh, his yeah,
very good, which is not looked at him strongly enough. He's a great ball player.
That's right.
I think it's the attachment of that to the long shot. That they're afraid of him going in as well as taking the long one. I didn't have a long shot, but he was still shooting with two hands.
That's right. Yeah, it's the triple threat. Is the triple threat? If you have the triple threat, right? You could make the long shot, or you can drive, or you can pass. Right?
Yes. And he's good at those other. He's a terrific passer, and a terrific, terrific driver to the basket. He got a great floater, great, uses both hands, all the things one should.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, no, this is great, Nick. I love these conversations where I could talk basketball for an hour for you. You know, I mean, just as easy as we could talk about literature. It's amazing. I want to take it back. I had that question I was thinking before. You mentioned lefty and the fact that, you know, you're through the process, you're choosing, right? You're choosing some of these people to publish and some not to. How do you make those decisions? How do you know when you have a lefty or these other greats?
It's very hard. And of course I've made some mistakes. I've certainly, as commercial gestures, I loved doing a book called French Fishing Flies. I think it was a good book to do. It probably was where I think Tom Rosenbauer told me that it was where he learned about Cool de Canard, and probably a lot of other people. But the book sold 800 copies, I think. It could not be sold. I promoted it as learning how the French do it. But it still wouldn't sell. And there were others. I often followed my passion down very unsuccessful commercial paths. I did a wonderful book on bamboo, just called Bamboo, by a man who had published a lot with Smithsonian and with National Geographic. Small man who is obsessed with bamboo, and he had brought it into the country and was trying to grow it himself so that he could make his own rods and so forth. And he spoke about the entire Tonkin region and where it came from. I thought it was a wonderful book. And that sold about 800 copies as well, which is a loss probably of $7,000 or $8,000, not much more than that. And there were others as well. I think that it's hard to tell various commercial aspects of a book. For me, it was less difficult to choose those which I thought were important, or in some way added to the knowledge of the world of fly fishing. I thought Lou Tabery's book really opened up striper fishing with a fly rod in a new way, which had never been opened before. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was worth doing. I think the book did well. I don't remember the statistics on it. But I did two or three other saltwater books, which I didn't know as well. Even one by Swisher and Richards on fishing in the Everglades didn't do well at all. I always tried to get the two of them together if I could, something that was valuable and something that could sell very well. I must say I also published what I thought were some very, very good non-technical books. I published Ted Leeson's books, all of them.
Oh, yeah.
I think he's a terrific writer. We did quite well with it. I republished all of Haig Brown's books, which I thought were important to do, even though it was, in some cases, the third or fourth time around. I did some salmon books, one by Lee Wolf, that I thought were important, even though I knew the numbers in salmon fishing are much, much lower than they are in trout.
Mm-hmm.
I felt very comfortable publishing Dave Whitlock, whom I like a lot, and I happen to like his rather cheery illustrations.
Mm-hmm.
But his knowledge of trout insects, what the insects are doing, how to deal with all aspects of fly fishing in rivers, is just wonderful.
Yeah.
I think that density of knowledge is what attracted me to his writing. The variety of writers, how good they are, differed a lot. Some of them were terrific writers, others had terrific knowledge and needed a little bit of work to protect them from obscurity and other difficult things that happen. But it is hard to make the decision. It's a question of looking at it and saying, does the world need another book on fishing the dry fly or not? Or does this say something that the other things, the other books don't say? Sometimes my interest in English fishing led me to pick books that I thought were very good, but were impossible to bring over here. I published Dermot Wilson's book on dry fly fishing, and that did not do well.
Hmm.
Yet I also did The Trout and the Fly by Goddard and Clark, and that must have sold very, very well. I'm not there for the final figures now, but it I think sold well over 100,000 copies here, which is a great sale.
Hmm.
That's another one that got a good general review in the New York Times. And as I don't know whether they still syndicate that column, but as the syndication went across the country, you could just see that one do well.
Hmm.
Did a very good book on fly tying by Jacqueline Wakeford, a wonderful tyer, beautiful woman. That did not do particularly well either. But it's interesting how in the Goddard and Clark book, there was something there that reminded me of the Swisher Richards book, that they were really breaking into some kind of new territory that I didn't know had existed, whether it exists. I had not
exactly
seen it existed. I think that's part of the selection. You've got, I think, to have a reasonable knowledge of how much has been written on a subject. And the fact that I had a great deal of passion for reading everything I could on fly fishing sure helped know what was out there and pretty much how it had done or what it had done to the market. So I learned about the marketplace as well as being a fly fisherman, a serious one, and reading a lot from my own knowledge, I knew what was, I think, saying something significant or important.
Yep.
I've had a number of people come to me with theories of one kind or another that I thought were off the wall, or like some of the worst conspiracies theories that are out there. And they just had no basis in fact, and I didn't do those. I was at the beginning of James Prozac's career. I didn't do his original book of drawings, but he was he's a very interesting person. He's very talented, very knowledgeable about a lot of different kinds of fishing. And I didn't do the first book of illustrations, which did very, very well, because I thought there were terrific illustrations, but I thought the amount of information on each of the fish was not sufficient to carry a book. I was wrong. He just took off like a shot, and everybody started promoting him. I eventually did a book of his called Fly Fishing and First Love, I think it was called, which is a pleasant book. It's one of the books of his that did not do very well. And he has since gone on to bigger and better things. But nice young man, very intelligent, and today already a great authority, in his 30s. Made a whole career of it.
Let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. OPST's rods represent decades of dedication to sustained anchor two-handed casting. A rod reflects its designer, and these rods are a true illustration of Skagit Master Ed Ward's vision. The Pure Skagit series falls right in line with OPST's principles, a short, medium, fast-action rod that sports an extra sensitive tip, all while maintaining a powerful lower section that's true and sure to leave you impressed by its feather-launching potential. And I've been using this rod for steelhead lately and been blown away by its lightweight and the power it packs. You almost don't realize it's in your hand. It's ultralight. So that was, thinking about how to describe this thing, I think that's the word that comes back to me. I was casting some big flies for steelhead with a sink tip and a bunch of wind, and I didn't have a problem at all, even with my less than perfect casting technique. So I've been impressed with the 11-foot 7-weight, but there is a huge line. They have three different rods in the lineup, from 6 to 9 weights, and from 10-foot 8-inch all the way up to 12-foot 3-inch, which pretty much, for me, covers it all. So I'm excited to dig into more of this. These rods actually diverge from the Micro series in a few ways. The upper grips are double-welded and thus aligned for the contemporary two-handed rods. While the lower handle still remains switch style, these rods are also slightly faster than the Micro series, being a true medium fast action that utilizes the upper third of the rod. Targeted towards fishing large trout and up to Canadian and Alaskan king salmon, this series should cover all the bases when targeting those larger fish. Head over to wetflyswing.com/OPST to check out the lineup right now. That's wetflyswing.com/OPST. Sawyer offers a full line of modern and traditional products for oarsmen, canoeists, kayakers, surfers, and paddlers of all genres, providing unsurpassed function, performance, and beauty. They design and handcraft every product in the USA, ensuring everything they make is from the highest quality materials with careful attention to detail. They take pride in their employees' stewardship of the environment and our country. In return, you have the assurance of knowing the product you receive from them is genuine, made in America, and cannot be replicated. I've been using Sawyer products for a long time now, which is why I'm definitely excited to share them with you on the podcast here. I've been down some crazy technical whitewater and mini fishing adventures that put me in places that were where I had to make a good move. And I love the design, the power, the performance, and always knowing that I can count on that stroke, even when you need to make, that one to get past the rock or whatever. You can always count on Sawyer for that. And you can count on them as well. Sawyer products are designed by paddlers, oarsmen, and surfers alike to fully meet your performance needs. Pick up one today and experience the feel of water. head over to wetflyswing.com/Sawyer to grab your set today. That's Sawyer, S-A-W-Y-E-R, wetflyswing.com/Sawyer to get started. Okay, back to the show. Haig Brown, we've talked about him. I mean, obviously, a lot of the people you're talking about, we've talked, covered on this show. Art Lindgren wrote a book, or has covered his life out of BC quite a bit. But the republishing thing, I had a question from the Facebook group. It was Jason Pereira. He was kind of asking about that, about buying up the rights from books. Can you just talk briefly about that process? It sounds like you've been doing that for a long time. Is that something, you know, that is still going on to this day? Is that pretty easy to do?
I think in most cases, it's a process of simply finding out who owns the rights and then seeing whether they want to see it. I'm asking whether they want to see it reprinted or not. In some cases where a British company, like the company that originally published G.E.M. Skews' books, are no longer in business, and you had to get that, I had to find out which company had bought them and who controlled the rights, whether they'd reverted to the family or not. Most publishing contracts have a clause that says if a book is out of print for a certain number of months, 6 or 12 months, and there is no intention to reprint, then the owner of the copyright, the author or the author's heirs, have the right to get the rights back, just have them reverted to them. And this happens a lot, where you have an individual who has had rights reverted to them. In a few cases, not so much with the fishing, as with some natural history that I published and some other books, it was hard to find the owner. Say the owner died in the 40s, the author and owner died in the 40s, the book company had been sold, and I had to do some research. My connections to some British publishers helped a lot in that respect. I would find out from them who bought Service Seeley, which was the original publisher of Skews. I think with a new book, you go to the publisher who's doing it, and if there's not too much competition, you can usually get the rights, lease the rights for $1,500, $2,000, $3,000. There are a lot of books being published in England right now, only a few of which I think can make the trip over to the United States and sell well. I've published several in my last days, or as a consultant to my son, who runs a publishing business now, that have not done well. In the case of Art Flick, I found Art. I asked him for the rights, and we made a contract and reprinted it. But I think you have to find out who the copyright holder is. In some cases, like 19th century books that have not been translated, the rights have fallen out of copyright. The copyright protection is only for about 75 years, I think. And even early books, I think some of the early Hemingways, actually not protected by copyright anymore, in which case a public domain book you can just take and reprint.
Oh, wow.
Though if it's been reprinted by people, you cannot produce your book from theirs without their permission, because there's a natural protection to the production process also, how it is laid out, how it is photographed and so forth. And there are usually notes, introductions, and other things that go along which are new and which are protected by copyright. But it's not an impossible process and not that difficult. I think there are fewer books from the 19th century or the early 20th century that are viable as books to reprint. The technology has changed so much by now and the interest in literature has perhaps diminished by so much by now that it's hard to find books that will do well. I'm very fond of a book, for instance, called Golden Days by a man named Romilly Fedden, which is public domain, published in about 1918 or 19, just after the First World War. I think it's a wonderful book about fishing in France just before the war, great days but that the man had. And then his best friend, the Frenchman, goes off to the war and dies within a month or so.
Oh, wow.
That's very moving. Very, very well written. Fedden went on to write other books on cooking and other things. But that's a terrific fishing book. And yet, when I republished it, I don't think I sold 300 copies of it.
So there's a lot of, it sounds like probably a lot of books out there still in the fly fishing space that, you know, either weren't published or weren't republished. Probably lots of good stuff, right? Maybe, I mean, when you look back at the history, you started kind of in the 60s, I guess, when you first started getting some of the publishing stuff going. When you look back at all the books before that, were there hundreds, thousands of books on fishing? Or what's your take on that, just the history of literature?
The British 19th century had wonderful writers. I think that the writers on dry fly fishing and on nymph fishing, the coming of it by that Skews wrote about, they're wonderful writers. I don't know whether they can sell today.
Yeah. Anymore.
I think they're, if you do them, they have to be done in small numbers. Every now and then there's some specialized publisher. I did one with a group of folks in upper New England who redid a batch. They had a whole fishing list, and they redid some in editions of only 1,000 copies, leather bound, with new introductions by modern writers. I wrote the introduction to one called Where the Bright Waters Meet by a wonderful writer named Plunkett Green, was his name, Harry Plunkett Green, who was about 6'5", I understand, and was an opera singer and would give the individual performances, would be a writer on stage. It's an absolutely delightful book about fishing a beautiful little river called the Bourne, which he just loves to pieces. He says that the trout were always gentlemen about it. They never were known to take a nymph. They only took the dry fly. It just has the best of English charm and some wonderfully funny and beautiful writing about fishing. The man just was crazy about his fishing. He just loved it. It's a terrific book. I think that publishing it in an edition of 1,000 is about the best you can expect. You can never sell more than that. So the question is partly, if you charge enough, if you charge $50 for it and you think you can sell 1,000 copies,
yeah,
probably going to make out at least paying for it and making a little money. But you can't do it as a commercial book. I think that book could not sell 800 copies here in the United States as a paperback, say. I don't think anyone would buy it, but it's terrific. I think those are judgments that you have to make. Some people go into the business. One person told me he went into the business, the publishing business, because he had a small fortune and he was told you could make a fortune in publishing, and he had a big fortune and he made it into a small fortune. losing a lot of money.
That's right. We joked about that a lot over the years here, just the fact that, you know, just going into fly fishing, you got to really have that passion because it's such a small niche. If you're going to try to make it your living and your career, you know, it definitely, you're not, I don't think there's really even a billion-dollar company in the space still.
Yeah.
So th- This is really interesting, Nick. I wonder, you know, I was looking through some of the recent, but I'm not sure if they're recent, but I saw a book in the Lions Press catalog. I think it was on Larry Bird. And I'm curious, you know, just generally, we talked some fly fishing books, but how much, you know, when you look at the inventory, either over the years or currently, is kind of fly fishing or fishing versus just all sorts of other topics?
I think it depends on the book. It's very hard to generalize. There are books like Swisher Richards and Art Flick and Tom Rosenbauer's Orvis book that have sold 250,000 copies or more over the years and continue to sell. I don't think any of them ever have the immediate sale that a good book in the sports field, a good golfing book, one on Tiger Woods at the right time when he's either at the head and top of his game, and there isn't an article on golf that doesn't mention his name. Sometimes those fall into the field of into the world of bestseller, and there are a great number of those sports figures, LeBron James today, basketball. At other times, if you get a little down the line, my son has published a book by played for the Knicks and was one of the first really Wigglers.
Oh, Frazier, yeah.
Not Frazier, but the other guard.
Oh, old school, older or newer? Let's see who that be.
Earl Monroe.
Oh, Earl the Pearl.
Yeah, and I met him. Tony, my son, had him in his office, and I met him. He's still skinny. He looks like he could play ball today.
You know, I was looking at a couple of your books. I picked up, I went to my bookshelf, and I've got Art Flick's Master Fly Tying Guide.
Yes.
And I've got Dave Whitlock's Guide to Aquatic Trout Foods. Two books that one came from, so the one was Crown, and then also The Lions was Dave Whitlock's book. And that's The Lions in Burford, right? That was before you became Lions Press? Or is that correct? Maybe I'm off on that.
I don't know. I think it probably is a Lions in Burford.
Yeah.
But it was always my business, and I brought this young man in, Peter Burford, and made him a partner.
Oh, gotcha.
Business. But eventually he left a few years later, and then I took the name The Lions Press. So the first book, the Crown book, would have been done when I was there and at Crown. And then that's one of the books I acquired and put on the Lions Press list.
That's right. That's right. Perfect. Well, I was going to check with you on dry fly fishing. I'm not sure how many books you had there, but we're kind of in a dry fly season. We're trying to touch on some of those topics. Do you know, is there one, did you have a number of dry fly related books?
I had a few. I redid Dermot Wilson's book called The Dry Fly, done in England.
Mm-hmm.
One of the better books I did was The Masters on the Dry Fly, which was an anthology put together by my friend Mike McGill, J.M. McGill, M-I-G-E-L. That was a very good dry fly book, and there were, I think, 14 chapters by different folks who fish the dry fly with some mastery. So I did that. Can't think of the others. I think that Gary LaFontaine did the Caddis book with me.
Oh, right.
But did not do the his book called The Dry Fly. He did that with someone else.
So he did, Caddis Flies, which is another book that just gets recommended so many times on this, you know, over the years. So, okay. So that gives us a couple. And then on these books, how many, you know, obviously there's a ton of books. Some of them are probably out of print. I mean, can we, like, as far as a resource, if you went to Lions Press, can you get a lot of these books we talked about today there, or is there some resource where we can look some of this up?
I think the best thing would be to contact the new Lions Press, which is owned by a company called Roman and Littlefield in Maryland. they would have, I think if you sent a list to the publicist, they would be able to the publicity department, they would be able to tell you immediately. Some of the books, and I'm not sure which, were let go out of print, and my son Tony acquired the rights and has them in his Skyhorse Press.
Oh, okay.
Skyhorse is his. It's all,
you know, gotcha.
100%. I know that I wrote an introduction to Selected Trout, for instance, and that's available from Skyhorse.
Oh, cool.
It's a new edition, and got some significant changes in it, made mostly by Doug Swisher. I think Carl had died before then.
Okay. So Skyhorse. So that was going to be my next question. If I recently had a guest, I'm not sure if you've heard of Art Lindgren, but he's out in BC and he's written a lot about like the history of Haig Brown. He's just wrote a book on Sid Glasso. And I was asking him about his books. He's written about 10 books in recent years, but none of them really have been published by a big publisher. Lots of small, like slow, you know, just a few hundred copies. If he was interested in like expanding out, would he, you know, connecting with Skyhorse or Lions? I mean, what would that process, if you had kind of a guy that maybe was producing small scale and wanted to elevate it, what would you recommend?
I think the best thing would be to go to one of those two houses. And I think he should consider them both. Tony runs a very good house, but his house is not as narrowly focused on, my son Tony, who owns, mm-hmm. It's not as narrowly focused on the outdoors as mine was, because Tony, though he's done some fishing, is not as obsessed by it.
Yeah.
The other place, on the other hand, the old place that has the old Lions Press is now connected to Stackpole, which is
a
fishing list.
Of course.
Both of them are owned by Roman and Littlefield. I don't know who the general editor is for both lists, but Judith Schnell, S-C-H-N-E-L-L, who was the publisher of Stackpole, is now handling all the Stackpole books for Roman and Littlefield, and I suspect she may have control of the books that come from my list also. At any rate, I could I could email you an address to get in touch with her.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I think the used books, fishing book shops like Ken Callahan, often have a very good selection of all the books I published, or know how to get them rather quickly. And I could give you the name of several like that also.
Okay, perfect.
I think the one on the West Coast that I know is Adams Angling. I'm not sure that he still deals in books, though. He may just deal in rare fishing tackle.
Okay. All right. Perfect. I was also thinking, you know, as we were kind of, I was thinking like, okay, if I'm going to have a few questions to wrap this thing up, we kind of broke here. We had a little bit of an audio thing. We're actually recording this second part now at the next day from when we started yesterday, but that's the beauty of the podcasting, is all seamlessly link this together. But, you know, Tom McGuane, you know, I had John Gearock on a while ago, and he talked about the impact, and he described how powerful his writings, you know, were and are. What was his influence on you? It sounds like you knew him a little bit or knew of his work.
McGuane's?
Yeah.
I think McGuane is the single best writer writing about angling today. He doesn't write that much, but what he's written, Silent Seasons and individual articles, the quality of the writing itself is unquestionably, I think, the very highest level. John has a wonderful prose style, which is very, very much accessible to everyone who fishes. McGuane's may be a little too esoteric, both in the syntax and in the references. I don't find it so, but that's my business. That's the trade that I'm in. I like John's writing very much, and I like particularly the way he turns the personal into something that becomes much more universal. and that everyone can enter into. I'm especially fond of Ted Leeson's work. Published it. I correspond with Ted to this day, and I think I wish he would write more. He seems to have quieted down after his last book, but The Habit of Rivers is a masterwork. I think it's a wonderful book. They all do something different. McGuane has a better overview of everything. I believe that Ted is an excellent writer within the philosophic and also the larger view. But if you look at the difference between a Leeson story or article and a McGuane, McGuane is capable of jumping in a variety of different directions, exploding in different directions. Ted chooses not to do that, but to give us a narrative that develops, which I think McGuane does brilliantly in his novels, but I don't think that he, and his short stories, but he doesn't often do it about fishing. He's less concerned with the day out and what it meant and who said what than he is about a larger picture. I think the three of them, the three is Ted, Girac, and McGuane.
Yeah.
Probably the leading writers today, though I don't keep up with things as much as I used at 88.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I think you're right. I mean, just from my perspective, I'm not obviously as accomplished or as well-read as you are, but when I think of it, definitely Girac, McGuane, and then Leeson. I mean, yeah, I can't think of anybody bigger even now. I mean, there's a lot of writing going on. And that's the interesting thing, kind of on my next question here with the, I'm sure you probably haven't embraced audiobooks, you know, as much as maybe some of the younger generation, but, you know, that's a big thing out there. And I've listened to a lot of books on tape. I mean, we're doing a podcast now. This is all audio. We're kind of teaching, right? We're teaching people through audio. What's your take on audiobooks? And do you think it's, you know, good or bad for just kind of what you've done for your career?
I have to admit that I know nothing about the field, that I think I've listened to one audio tape, not on fishing at all, but on art, actually, which my late wife liked very much. I have nothing against it. I think it's a nice way to acquire, to enter into. And I think it's essentially healthy. It should not, for anybody, take the place of a book, which is a different pace. Audio comes in and it doesn't stop unless you stop it. When you read something, it stops every second that you stop. And it's a very different reading experience. You've got to read slowly or you're going to miss half the sentence. And when you rush along, you miss some of the best things that take place. I prefer very much the book to the ebook and also to the audio. But I think audio only helps. I would love to hear somebody read their own work, for instance. I'd prefer it more if the author read it. I once heard the poet E. Cummings read, and I would bet that I know that I didn't understand the poems until I heard him read them. Just the inflection and the like. I wish more writers would read their own work, and I wish the audio field was more generous to the fact that the sound of the spoken word by the person who wrote it is great value to the listener. But I don't think it's hurt the books at all. I think it only stretches out their possible influence.
So exactly. I think it hits a new, probably hits another audience. And so, I mean, just like this, we're people are listening to this now and they're going to listen to this and they're going to, like me, I've never talked to you before this, but hearing you talk for an hour here has been amazing because I have a way better perspective just on what you're talking about of you, just from listening to the, how you're very meticulous and obviously analytical.
For better or worse, we learn more when we hear the spoken voice. I think that it is the spoken voice of the person who wrote the material that I think is the most valuable. Yeah. But there are professional readers who are very good, and I have heard bits and pieces of people reading a novel. I heard a lady friend of mine likes Middlemarch by George Eliot, and I heard a snippet of reading, and it was done by a professional reader of great skill. And I think that can bring out new meanings as well. I wouldn't say it should ever only be the author.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I've heard great readers, people that have read books for other authors, and yeah, if they're really skilled, it definitely comes across really well. So, okay, Nick, well, I think that's about all I have. I was just going to kind of wrap it up here. You know, you mentioned, I guess in the next 6 to 6 months or so, it sounds like you've got at least one book that's out there. You want to give us a reminder on that book, and then what else do you have, anything else you have coming in the next year or so?
Sure. I can't fish anymore. I have rotator cuff problems, which makes casting almost impossible. And I have a great balance problem, which keeps me away from rivers where I don't particularly want to end things by drowning in 1 foot of water. I'm writing much more about other matters. And the book that I finished in September, in my 88th year, is really the only true autobiography I've ever written, from the early days that I spent in a boarding school. My father had died 3 months before I was born. My mother pretty much froze up and tried to make a go of it as a single mother, and I think run a little business, but I think put me in the boarding school as something that she had to do. I spent 3 years there and then pretty much wasted my early years, mid years. And it wasn't until I went into the Army that I really began to say, what do I want to do with my life? And the book really is about this. Fire in the Straw is the name of the book. And it's about me, who discovers at a certain age, not particularly early, that the little fire, the passion, the love of doing something is what you should pursue in your life if you possibly can. I had been sort of pushed into the Wharton School, which is a wonderful business college, the University of Pennsylvania. And as I mentioned earlier, I played for the basketball team in the early 50s. But I hated the course I was taking. I got C's and D's.
Yep.
Just managed to get through. I was studying insurance. And then when I changed, the language of insurance did not prepare me for the language of Yeats and Aaron Keats and all the others. So it was a very dramatic change. The book is about that change. And then after I changed and gotten a PhD in English, the remainder of the book is how you hold on to it somehow, what you do to protect this fire that you've somehow gotten out of the flame. And it has some fairly dark sections. The death of my wife, whom I was married to for 58 years, and the death of my oldest son, Paul, a professor of English, and some dark days that I had when I lived in a tiny little room in Greenwich Village and determined that I wanted to be a writer. And the writing came back in the mail almost. I thought that the New Yorker had somebody down at the main post office. It seemed to come back this next day. I'd put it in the mail and this little pink slip would come back. No, not for us, or something like that. But those years of trying to be a writer, which were really years that went into my 30s. I don't think I was under 35 when I wrote my first stories. And I tell the circumstances of those. Those were fishing stories about a trip I'd taken with a remarkable heavy drinker. It took us 9 hours to get to the Beaver Kill, which was only an hour and a half away. And then another story about the first trout I ever caught, which I got by gigging it. I put a hook in its mouth and yanked. It was summer. And those really got me started on the writing about fishing. And that's in the book, In Fire and the Straw, also. So there's a little of that fishing part of my life. But also I was a teacher for 28 years in both University of Michigan and Hunter College, a book publisher for another 25 or 30 years, some of it simultaneously. I wrote, did ghostwriting, then finally had some wonderful years at the end when I was what you would call retired, when I just wrote, I just helped my wife, Mary, as much as I could, and where she illustrated some of the books I was writing, which enabled us to do something together, really for the first time. I think it's in the aggregate, it's a very happy book in the discovery, the fact that I did discover this and I did have a rich, very full life. But it has its dark moments and not connected to fishing at all.
There you go. Well, as you're talking there, I'm not sure if you've heard of Stephen Pressfield, but he wrote this book I've talked about before. It's called The War of Art. And the basic premise is that, you know, like he talks about the struggling artist that really loved writing and he always wanted to be a writer. But, you know, for 20 years, he just struggled at it. He was, you know what I mean? He was like literally living in his car at a certain point. But eventually he got there. And I kind of throw this question back at you because you mentioned about how it sounds like you've done some amazing stuff and done what you want to do. What would be your advice to somebody out there who's maybe, you know, maybe in their 40s right now doing a job, but they're really interested going all in on their passion, you know what I mean? But they've still got to pay the bills. They got to feed the kids, but they really want to go in on this other thing. What would you tell that person?
I've been there. I know that problem. And I think you do a lot of things to protect the family. I don't think it has to, perhaps it doesn't have to live as richly as you've been providing for it. Perhaps you could pull back. But you must start to do what you want to do, maybe a little at a time, and then build it. I would say there's virtually no chance that a very slim chance that someone's setting out on let's say writing at midlife without having done it to say I'm going to be a writer and I'm going to earn my living at it.
Yeah.
The New Yorker gets, I believe, 20,000 submissions.
Wow.
Any given month. And they accept 1 to 0, I was told. They have their own staff writers, of course.
Yeah.
The odds are very tough. And I think that in my case, the three things that I found, first I had to discover what I wanted to do. Then I had to take a look at it and see whether I could do it. Could I write? For 10 years I wrote, and I wrote some graduate school essays and had them published, but nothing I wrote was of any joy to me or any significance, or did it pay much? And when Field and Stream sent me a 2-line note, "We love your story, Mecca, and a check for $1,000 to you," I almost peed in my pants. Seemed terrific. And ended up writing hundreds and hundreds of the fishing stories, which I love to write. So it's the first thing, you discover what you want to do. Then you try to see whether you can do it or not. And I think you also, in my case, I realized that I was pretty dumb and that I was illiterate. I didn't know anything about this world of literature. So I did the hard thing. I went back for a doctorate in a different subject, in literature, which was very hard. I already had a wife and two children. I had a tiny bit of money that I'd saved in the Army. And while I was going to graduate school, I started to teach to pay the bills, which is, I never thought I'd be a teacher. And I also took in typing. And it wasn't beneath me. Nothing I've ever done, even the ghostwriting, I never considered beneath me.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot about ghostwriting by coming in and writing someone else's book by use of a tape recorder and some imagination.
Hmm.
I did about four or five of them, and then I didn't have to do them anymore financially. So I started writing more of my own. But sometimes you can find a parallel job, one that will teach you something about the thing you want to do most. Ghostwriting gave me that. Editing gave me that. And then the final thing is learning how to survive at it, you know, just to keep it alive.
That's the survival piece.
It's a hard decision.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's it.
Traditional answer, Dave, is don't give up your day job.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Don't give up the day job. You got it until you can do it. No, I appreciate that. Well, Nick, I think this is pretty good. I mean, I was just thinking, you know, I think back, my dad had a little fly shop back when I was a kid, and I've been reading your stuff my entire life. You know, I've got books on the shelf that I know I've had when I was 5 years old, you know what I mean? Before I could even read, because I was sitting around the fly shop. And so I just want to thank you for that, you know, the influence and all the people, you know, that are listening to this now and down the line that are going to read your stuff. I just appreciate all the work you put in, and thanks for coming on today.
Thank you, Dave. I loved all of the fishing writing I did. I didn't do it to make the $1,000 as much as I wrote it to, just because such wonderful things happened to me on the water. And they, living in cities a lot of my life, it gave me a way to relive those days on the water. But that's different from having had a career in it, I guess.
Exactly. Hey, Nick, would you mind if I read something? I had an email. You got me thinking. I got a short little email. This came from Simon. I told Simon, he sent me this. He's from, he listens to the podcast in England. I'm not exactly sure. But he sent me this email, and it's pretty powerful. I told him, I sent him an email back, and I said, hey, do you mind if I read this on the air? Because it's pretty powerful. What Simon said was, he said, hi, Dave. I know that I'm a little by myself. I had a stroke a couple years ago, which has left me a little worse for the wear. I cannot drive anymore, so I have to travel by train and taxi. My right hand leg swells up if I walk anywhere. My right arm swells up when I do too much, and my shoulder gives me pain, but I travel by train to the nearest station and get a taxi from there. A day's fishing on the reservoir in one of their boats cost me about 95, I guess that's UK dollars a day. I can't really fish because of the walking is so painful. I love my fly fishing that much. I won't give it up. Yours, Simon.
That's a wonderful letter.
Isn't that amazing?
That's very moving. Good for him.
I know.
I wish him all the very, very best.
I know. This is a shout out to Simon for sure. And I mean, to everybody. I mean, you're, like you said, I think you're 88 now. And, you know, again, it's we've all got the pains, and then you're still going strong. So, Nick, I just want to thank you again, and we'll keep in touch with you.
Great. Thank you, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
So there you go. If you want to find all the show notes with all the links we covered, just go to wetflyswing.com/202. If you get a chance, check out the members group. We've got a group of people that are supporting this show for about the price of a cup of coffee. You can go to wetflyswing.com/members or click the link at our homepage. And it'd be great to have you there. And this helps kind of keep things moving along here and paying the bills to keep this thing going. So I appreciate it if you've already subscribed over there. Also, calling all co-hosts. If you are interested in co-hosting this show, the Member Society is the place to find out how to do it and your chance if you want to join. So if you have interest, head over there and check it out. Send me a DM there and we can chat. Also, if I get a little energy and can do it, I might put together a PDF of all the writers and books that Nick talked about today. He really covered a ton of stuff. So I was kind of frantically trying to keep up with it as he was talking about all the great writers, you know. So and Lions Press Publishing, even though Nick is, you know, has sold that, that's still a place you can see a lot of the, check out a lot of those books or talk to the publisher, the current editor or publisher there, and check it out. That's pretty much a wrap. You can go to, like I said, wetflyswing.com/202. Check out the show notes. I want to thank you today for stopping by to check out the show. Hope to maybe catch up with you soon, maybe on the river or maybe online.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.